way government regains the trust of its citizens is by telling the truth. There is no other way, no shortcut.
And I call upon our government to open up like the Belgians have, the French have, the Brazilians have, the Argentines, the Mexicans have all released their files. It's about time now that we do the same thing and become a part of this planetary community.
It is way past time for all of us to know what our own government knows, instead of being kept in the dark by a policy of denial.
The last time that Congress held a hearing addressing the extraterrestrial issue was 1968, 44 years of sightings ago. In those 4.5 decades, hundreds of thousands of new sightings have taken place. Government agency witnesses have come forward. Media coverage has expanded. Hundreds of documentaries have been produced. Thousands of books have been written. And yet the United States Congress has remained silent. So for a period of 5 days, at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., 2 blocks from the White House, and 12 blocks from the Congress of the United States, we're going to conduct a citizen hearing on disclosure of an extraterrestrial presence engaging the human race. 40 to 50 witnesses of high rank and station, from military, from agencies, possibly from intelligence services, along with the top researchers in the world, will give 30 hours of testimony to 5 former members of the United States Congress.
So maybe a citizens' hearing has a chance to try to leverage open some of the truth about the fact that we're not alone in this universe, that we might actually begin to look at what we really are, what the true history of this planet is, and that might be what gets us into a future without self-destruction.
The motto of the citizen hearing is, if Congress won't do its job, the people will.
Greetings, everybody, and welcome to Galactic Roundtable, the countdown for disclosure. We're going to go back to our normal programming today, and I have a jam-packed program for you. I'd like to jump right into a review of one of the witnesses for the citizens hearing, April 29th to May 3rd, at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. My brain got behind my words. My words were spilling out and my brain wasn't there. Today's guest that we're featuring is Nick Pope. Nick Pope worked at the United Kingdom Ministry of Defense for 21 years. His postings included being assigned to the Joint Operations Center during the Persian Gulf War, where he was a briefer in the Air Force Operations Room. He left the MOD in 2006 after his final posting, in which he served as an acting deputy director in the Directorate of Defense Security. He now works as a journalist and broadcaster, covering subjects including space, fringe science, defense, and intelligence. Between 1991 and 1994, Nick Pope was posted to a division called Secretariat Air Staff, where his duties included researching and investigating the UFO phenomena, mirroring the work done in America in the 1960s by the United States Air Force's Project Blue Book. Although most sightings could be explained as misidentifications of known objects and phenomena, a small proportion appeared to defy any conventional explanation. These included cases where the witnesses were pilots, police officers, and military personnel, cases where UFOs had been tracked on radar, and cases where there had been near misses between UFOs and civilian aircraft. Nick Pope takes no position on the nature of the UFO phenomena, but can testify, based on his governmental research and investigation, that it raises important defense, national security, and air safety issues. Nick Pope has recently been involved in a 5-year program to declassify and release the MOD's entire archive of UFO files, a process which began in 2008 and comes to its climax in 2013. To date, this has involved the release to the UK's National Archives of over 50,000 pages of UFO-related documentation, some of which had formerly been classified secret UK eyes only. So the piece of work that we're going to look at today is Nick Pope speaking on the Rendlesham Forest incident. And in America, it's known as Bentwater. He has several other presentations that are not like this one at all, which would probably encompass the body of his work better. But I picked this presentation because I think in the United States, we don't know a lot about the Rendlesham Forest case, and it's the most important UK case ever. It's there, Roswell. So let's hear what Nick has to say about this.
Knowledge. So with that in mind, I want now to turn to Rendlesham. And I'm aware, not least from Gary's show of hands question in the last presentation, obviously I'm aware that pretty much everyone here is aware of the Rendlesham Forest incident. But I am, just for the one or two who aren't, and really just as a primer, just going to tell a very brief summary of the case as I see it, before I pick up one or two issues about the consequences of all this. This is clearly Britain's best known and most compelling incident. I think it suffers from an image problem. And again, actually, branding is very important in ufology. Roswell is a brand. And you know it's a brand because you can go outside the UFO community, you can stop someone on the street, and the chances are they will probably have heard of Roswell, whether they believe it or not, but they will have heard of it. Rendlesham Forest actually suffers from what advertisers, I think, call mixed message, in that here it's known as Rendlesham incident. In the US, it's generally known as Bentwaters. And actually, that's not helpful. That's actually not helpful because you're splitting the interest. And there is, in some people's mind, confusion. What, two different cases? Oh, it's the same case, but different name. It's not helpful. Not sure what we can do about it, but we are where we are. Sorry, Frankie's giving me a look there, because one of the things I taught her is, from my own media training, is that if you watch a politician get asked a difficult question about something that's happened in the past on Newsnight, they'll say, well, we are where we are, but what we've now got to do is move forward, and completely not answer the question. So, anyway, we are where we are. We just have to deal with that as we can. This is a multiple witness event. It's what I call the perfect storm of ufology, because it has just about everything that makes a UFO case compelling. It's a multiple witness event. Those witnesses are credible, trained observers. I mean, not just are they military, they're military cops. The two categories of people most involved were security police, SP, law enforcement, LE. If you could want for two categories in terms of their skill sets, those would probably be the two categories that you'd pick. It was tracked on radar. This is not universally known, but again, there was an RAF radar operator called Nigel Kerr, who years after the event actually recalled, and he didn't realise that he had this piece of the puzzle. He recalled getting a call from the control tower at Bentwaters to say, is there anything on your screens unusual? And he said for two or three sweeps of the radar, yes, there was an uncorrelated target right over the base when the call came in, and then it faded away. So we've got multiple witnesses, military witnesses. They're actually security police and law enforcement, tracked on radar. And very briefly, as many of you will know, the story is that in the early hours of the 26th of December 1980, lights were seen in Rendlesham Forest, and some of those concerned thought that perhaps a light aircraft had crashed and was on fire. They sought and obtained permission to go off base and investigate. The three individuals involved were Jim Peniston, John Burrows, and Ed Kavanasak. They all went out there. Kavanasak was told to hold back because the communications were failing. There's something we hear in quite a lot of cases, radio interference. So Kavanaugh-Sack was told to hold back and act as a communications relay between Burroughs and Peniston as they approached the object and between the base. Peniston and Burroughs both approached this and found that it was not a crashed aircraft. It was a landed UFO. Jim Peniston recalls that he got close enough to touch the side of this thing to see strange symbols that he likened to Egyptian hieroglyphs. The UFO then, fairly small triangular thing, which he said looked to have smashed its way down, not crashed, but perhaps a heavy landing, and it was hovering or on legs in a small clearing. Looked a little bit like a lunar module, landing module. I'm sure you've seen all the images. They're widely available. He said suddenly this thing then took off again and then shot off at huge speed. As he, Jim Peniston, wrote in his police notebook, speed impossible. That was how he described it. They went back to the base, reported what they'd seen. Colonel Holt told them to write up their reports, which they did, along with a couple of the other people involved, Chandler and Baran, who were also in the chain of command that night. The following night, there's a social function. Colonel Holt, deputy base commander, is there. The doors burst open. A young officer comes up, salutes, says, "Sir, it's back." Holt looks momentarily confused. He says, "What are you talking about? What's back?" "The UFO, sir. The UFO's come back." So Holt threw together a small team of personnel, went out into the forest, in his own words, to debunk this nonsense. He didn't want this. This was a problem. One thing you don't want at a military base is a problem. Let's put this to bed. Let's see what they've really seen, and let's just move on. As I'm sure most of you know, he was not able to debunk this nonsense, quote unquote, because he himself became a witness to this. He saw the UFO, it not landed, as in the previous night, but in the sky, performing extraordinary maneuvers, zigzagging around at some stage. I'm sure many of you have heard the tape where he discusses this. He's recording his thoughts on a handheld tape recorder. And at one point, the UFO is firing light beams down at the base. One of the other things that Holt does is he has the disaster preparedness guy. I mean, this, you know, if you look at the names of the sorts of, or rather the categories of who's involved in all this, you can see how it would start a few conspiracy theories. You know, they brought the disaster preparedness guy out there with them, but they did, Munro Nevels. And Munro Nevels is the guy with the Geiger counter, and he's the guy that took the radiation readings. There is some controversy and debate about the radiation readings. Were they read accurately on the meter? Are they significant? If you look at the MOD's own case file on this, as opposed to what either the believers or the skeptics in the UFO community, look at what the Defense Intelligence Staff scientists say. They say the levels seem significantly higher than background. I think the most important point, though, about those radiation levels is not a debate about where they were in the scale, but is the simple fact that they got peak readings in the three indentations where this thing apparently came down on legs or some sort of tripod-like device. So you can have all sorts of debates about was it 8 or 9 on the scale. The point is it went bleep where the UFO was. And that's interesting and that's important. And I think sometimes in the UFO community, people can zero in almost obsessively on a really small detail. And it's an important detail, yeah, when, you know, what were the exact levels. But sometimes in zeroing in, you can actually forget to zoom out and take an overview of the big strategic issue. And here, As I say, the big issue is not whether the reading was X or Y. It's the fact that they got the peak readings in the site where the UFO landed. So, again, I labour that point because I think it's an important one. Now, I want now to tell... I mean, that's the bare bones. That's the bare bones of the story. What I want to do now is move on to effectively my cold case review of this. I undertook in 1994 at the MOD what the police would call a cold case review, which is where, like an unsolved murder, as it were, or like any unsolved case, you have a fresh look at a historical incident, and you say, well, in the light of, can we find a new witness? Has the DNA technology moved sufficiently so that we can revisit this case? And one often hears, and you know, in newspapers these days, instances of people being convicted of usually something like rape years after an event because the DNA technology has now advanced. So I looked back at Rendlesham and I said, how was this investigated at the time? What was done correctly and what was done incorrectly? I think Gary's heard me make these points before, but my last job in the MOD was with the Directorate of Defence Security, and I actually worked quite closely with a lot of military police, Royal Military Police, Royal Air Force Police, MDP. So actually in working with cops, I got quite a useful education into the mindset of cops, and one of the things that they were always saying to me was, look, if an investigation goes wrong, you often find these two words or concepts somewhere in the mix. The first is delay, and the second, the concept, is poor information sharing. And what one finds is in policing, as within in the medical profession, you talk about whether it's the golden hour, the golden 24 hours, but you unless you get to something quickly, your chances of then getting the bottom of it diminish rapidly. So police in a crime, we're very quickly trying to identify and interview the witnesses, secure and recover the evidence. And that is exactly, of course, what should have been happening here. But yet, actually, and this is where things get surprising, given that we did have security police and law enforcement involved, the two critical things that they should have known fatally would undermine any investigation, both actually happened. Firstly, there was huge delay in dealing with this. And look, I mean, for all the points about, well, Donald Morland, the UK liaison officer, was on Christmas leave, so I waited for him to come back. Look at the two-week gap between the incident and between Colonel Holt notifying the Ministry of Defence. Two lost weeks. It was an absolute disaster in terms of the investigation. The other thing, poor information sharing, Police Force A knows something. Of course, we had the Bichard inquiry. About the terrible events of Soham and Ian Huntley, where, you know, there was this question that Police Force A, had they known what Police Force B knew, should never have given Huntley a job. So there are huge information sharing issues. And yet, it all went horribly wrong with Rendlesham. The United States Air Force was doing its investigation. Colonel Holt was interviewing witnesses, taking statements, not sharing that information back with the Ministry of Defence. When the Ministry of Defence, after this horrendous two-week delay, when we started it, we started doing things like pulling the radar tapes, getting the Defence Intelligence staff, as I've mentioned, to analyse the radiation levels that Holt did report in his memo. Guess what? We didn't share that information back with the Americans. So it was a complete disaster from A to B. I think, in fairness, two things. Firstly, police and military tend to operate to standard operating procedure, your SOPs, and this was so unlike anything that they'd ever come across before, it's kind of, well, this isn't in the manual. But I think they should have worked around that. Second thing is actually, under the NATO Status of Forces Agreement, issues of jurisdiction and primacy are actually quite complicated. And arguably, in terms of dealing with this incident, jurisdiction can be what's called concurrent. In other words, both the Americans and the British were empowered to actually investigate this, or certainly some aspects of it. But there should always be primacy. One person, one body should be in charge, and everyone should know who that person or body is. And that didn't happen with Rendlesham. And that's extremely unfortunate. My point here is that the investigation was fatally flawed from day one. A couple of interesting anecdotes. One of the most interesting pieces of documentary evidence about all this, again, it's in the Rendlesham Forest file, but sometimes the best place to hide a book is in a library. General Gabriel, Commander-in-Chief, United States Air Force in Europe, visited the base very shortly after the incident, took possession of certain items, including Colonel Holt's tape, took them back to his headquarters in Ramstein. What happened to those items? What else was taken? Why the unscheduled visit? Those of you in the military or with military backgrounds will know the laughable phrase in the MOD's document. General Gabriel, CNC Yousafi, who just happened to be visiting the base. CNC Yousafi does not just happen to do anything. His diary is probably set pretty much a year in advance, as things are at that level. And when something ad hoc happens, like a visit, something has clearly happened of extreme significance. What was very interesting is my great friend Georgina Bruni, who tragically died a couple of years ago and did so much, by the way, for this case in terms of obtaining documents, finding new witnesses. Georgina Bruni and I had dinner a few years ago with General Gordon Williams, who was the commanding officer of the twin bases, Bentwaters and Woodbridge. It's a unified command structure. And Gordon Williams was not aware that General Gabriel had visited. Now, again, any of you in the military or with military backgrounds will know it is inconceivable that a commanding officer of a base, even if they were on leave, would not be briefed that someone of that level was visiting, because they would obviously want to either change their leave plans so that they were present, or certainly have a very tight control on what the general's visit program looked like, and they would want to be involved in that process. So an unscheduled visit by Commander-in-Chief, United States Air Force in Europe, shortly after the incident, taking items back to Ramstein. As I say, some FOI requests, I think, from American researchers are following up these sorts of issues, but it's very interesting. One of the fascinating little things about Rendlesham, I think, is that unlike much of ufology, which can sometimes be quite male-dominated, it's interesting that all the key investigators of this have been female. First of all, Jenny Randalls, Brenda Butler, Dot Street, then more recently Georgina Bruni, and now Linda Moulton Howe in the States is doing some phenomenal work, by the way, on this case. Has teamed up with John Burroughs and the two of them lecture together. One of her key contributions, I think, is going after and finding and getting on the record testimony, not just from the B-flight people, whose names you're all familiar with, Peniston and Burroughs and so, but people like Laurie Bowen, Doc Rhodes, and Bonnie Tamplin. And testimony from people who perhaps those names might not be as familiar to some in the audience. They soon will be, I'm sure. One of the fascinating little anecdotes, by the way, that Linda came up with was that she spoke to both Steve LaPlume and Wendell Palmer. And a couple of weeks after the Rendlesham incident, he was at the one of the gates, and suddenly, he said, a huge convoy of cars came out of the base and into the forest. And as he waved them past, he said he was shocked to see that the people in the car going out into the forest, apparently to look for UFOs, was Colonel Conrad and his wife and children. Colonel Williams, commanding officer, and Colonel Holt. So all the top brass of the base piling out of the base into the forest because apparently there'd been another sighting. And again, there's far more, I think, to all of this than meets the eye. We're in the 30th anniversary year. There's going to be a lot more about this than you're currently aware of. Gary spoke about his plans for a Hollywood movie, and I wish him well with that. I think it's a great story and one that very much would lend itself to a Hollywood treatment. There is still talk of a reunion of witnesses, though I think they're debating about whether that's going to be in the States, where most of them are based, or whether it's going to be over here. I know a number of documentary filmmakers are looking at this, and doubtless there will always be, as there is in the TV business, the last-minute approach from someone who's never heard of this case, hears it, I don't know, in about October this year probably, and thinks, gosh, I'd better try and rush out a quick documentary in time for the anniversary. But be that as it may, there is going to be a lot about this. I'm going to conclude with something that Frankie mentioned yesterday. Again, Leslie Kane's book, this is published on Tuesday, I think. There are one or two advanced copies circulating. Get it on Amazon. So Amazon, I've turned into an American here. Get it on Amazon. Get it on Amazon. And it's up there already. And it is, Frankie mentioned it yesterday, it's extraordinary because it's not the UFO community. It is exclusively pilots, government personnel, aviation community personnel who've either seen a UFO or been involved in official investigations thereof. John Podesta wrote the foreword. As Frankie said, I think he's Bill Clinton's former chief of staff. He was head of Obama's transition team. Yes, we've heard from him before, but hang on, writing a foreword to a UFO book, this moves things on critically. I'll read just a tiny little quote from a chapter that Charles Holt has contributed. We've heard this story before, but I don't think we've heard it in his own words, and certainly not in a book with a foreword by Bill Clinton's chief of staff. Many have wondered how much the US government might know about the Rendlesham Forest incident. Over the years, it has become clear to me that agents from the Office of Special Investigations, the Air Force's major investigative service, were on the base and secretly investigated the case in the following days. The incident had everyone very nervous. The high-ranking officers wanted to stay out of it, and the OSI didn't want anyone involved whom they couldn't control. Here comes the killer. OSI operatives harshly interrogated five young airmen, some of them in shock at the time, who were key witnesses. These men reported later that the agents told them not to talk about the UFO events or their careers would be in jeopardy. Drugs, such as sodium pentanol, often called a truth serum when used with some form of brainwashing or hypnosis, were administered during these interrogations, and the whole thing has had damaging and lasting effects on the men involved. Is that a bombshell or is that a bombshell? This book's coming out on Tuesday. It's going to get some major, major mainstream media coverage in the US. I'm hoping some of that will spill over here. Now we're in a global media society. But I think, in conclusion, what I would say is this. I don't know what happened at Rendlesham Forest. I know it wasn't the lighthouse. I know it wasn't a burning manure truck. I know it wasn't a hoax. I know it wasn't a police car with its lights on. I don't know what it was, but whatever it was of extreme defense significance. And as Colonel Holt has here said in his own words, it left the people under his command in shock. Some of them are still traumatized to this day. Some of them I'm sure you've met or seen on TV. There is evidence of post-traumatic stress disorder. It's not surprising that some of them are pushing for congressional inquiries on this. I don't have time to go into this, but in relation to the Iraq inquiry, one has heard a lot about the military covenant. The military covenant says that because our young men and women in the military put their lives on the line for their country and the chain of command owes them big time and must ensure that loyalty does not just go up the chain of command, it comes back down the chain of command. And the men and women must be properly trained, equipped and looked after. I think that in relation to the Rendlesham Forest incident, there is clear evidence that the military covenant was not offered. And I think some of the people feel that the chain of command did not give them the support that they should have given in this. So as I say, I do not know what happened at Rendlesham. I know what it wasn't. I don't know what it was. But as I say, this is the most compelling case we have in the UK. It's interesting, it's important, and it's not going to go away. Thank you very much.
Sorry, I just thought we would just spend the next couple of minutes. Does anybody have any questions? Okay, yeah, I figured there probably would be. Do you guys mind coming down? Just, okay, first question.
So, Nick, what happened to the photographs that Jim Peniston said that he took around the craft?
Jim Peniston said that several photos were taken. He's not the only one. Several other people say that they or others took photos, and indeed some people say moving film footage too. All this was turned over to the base lab, and they were told that the UFO was so bright that the film was fogged and nothing came out. That's what they were told. I don't know if it's true, but that's certainly what the witnesses that I've spoken to said they were told. And to be fair, of course, Peniston and Burroughs said, well, yeah, it was pretty bright. So that might be true, but that's what they were told.
And you mentioned light beams coming down to the ground on the base. Can you confirm all the reports that suggest the light beams actually scrambled electronics in nuclear warheads stored at the base, and they had to fly in experts from Germany to reprogram the warheads?
That story is widely out there on the internet. Without wanting to sound too much like the man from the on anything to do with nuclear issues, it's a no comment from me. I mean, it's been the long-standing policy of the British government neither to confirm nor deny the presence of nuclear weapons in any particular location. And I've signed the Official Secrets Act. It still binds me, so sorry, I'm not going to go on that, but there's plenty of material on the on the internet from some of the witnesses, so see what they say.
You talked about the Royal Society debates, and how that it's sort of set suddenly picking up radio signal or something. That might be a story. Do you think, that's my roundabout way of asking, do you think that there's pretty good programming at play in our society and civilization? In terms of aliens and UFOs.
Sorry, predictive programming?
Predictive programming in that culture.
Do you mean, is this part of an acclimatization program, do you mean? I don't know. There are certainly many in the UFO community who feel that things like sci-fi movies constantly pushing the image, images of greys on T-shirts, Royal Society. People feel that this is a part of an acclimatization program. I'm not convinced, personally. I just think it's, in terms of the film, I think it's entertainment and money. In terms of the Royal Society, I think it's a big question that science is legitimately interested in. So I don't buy into acclimatization.
Larry Warren's quite a controversial character in the Rendlesham incident. What's your thoughts on Larry?
Well, I know Larry, and we've sunk a few cold ones together, as they say in the States. Larry was certainly there. I'm convinced he was involved. But I think some of his critics have pointed out that his story has changed somewhat. I would say two things in his defense. It was 30 years. And if I was asked to describe something that happened 30 years ago, I would probably tell the story in some respects different today than 30 years ago. I think the other clue is in what Charles Holt said. If people were interrogated and threatened and drugged, that is a way in which memories can be scrambled. And that might have been part of the process. And that may explain some of what's happened to Larry. Oh, Rich.
Yeah,
I was going to say
the last question. Oh, no,
an ultimate question. Very much. Regarding the issue of laser-like lights coming down to where the nuclear weapons were stored.
Allegedly.
I chatted with Peter Robbins extensively. Peter and Larry Warren in the early 90s had a discussion with Charles Holt. And in which Hall said to them that the beams, this is a direct quote according to Peter, adversely affected the ordnance. And Peter, who we've known for many years, absolutely stands by that statement. And I just thought, if you're not able to say it, fair enough.
Two points on that. Were there nuclear weapons? Yes, there were. I have four graphs. I worked on the nuclear base, doing exactly the same job as what the law enforcement and the police officers, the American police officers, thought and did. Between 1983 and 1989, I worked as a Royal Air Force policeman and served two nuclear security bases at Honington in Suffolk and Lyme in what was then West Germany. I worked in an identical layout of the site of the headquarters storage area. I have a photograph that is an exact match of the Lahrbruck site in Germany to the exact specification of the headquarters site. It was a nuclear facility. Holt will never openly say it for reasons that Nick wants, but I will say it was nuclear. Everything about that was nuclear. Based that on the fact that the number of officers involved in that case in protecting that site was well over 40 on a conventional bomb dump, it's literally only on two. So it's proven in the detail. So it was nuclear, but the political reasons. If Nick was to say that it was definitely nuclear, if Holt was to say it was definitely nuclear, it would have been in breach of all the assault agreements and caused World War III in terms of big political damage. So nobody's ever going to do that, but it was nuclear. With regards to Larry Warren, I've met him several times. I spent a lot of time with him in Loughlin in February this year. He was the original whistleblower. It is a controversial account. His life has been well and truly messed up as a result of this. If there is ever one person who's had post-traumatic stress, it is Larry Warren. And he is responsible for getting his story out there. With others, he was the first one. We cannot edit history. It's a controversial account. Minds were messed with, and they had no authority to do it. So there is some coming back to the government at some point. It's a very brilliant case, and we should do all we can to get it out there, because the world should know about this case.
Yeah.
Let me... thank you, Gary, for that comment about Larry, and thank you to both Gary and to Richard, for making the other point that they did, and I hope the audience will understand. I thank you for making the point about the ordinance. I hope the audience will understand why I chose not to. But it's, as I say, it is interesting, important, and in this 30th anniversary year, we should be having this debate. Thank you.
That was so great.
Thank you.
All right, everybody. Now, what I'd like to do next is, we've been talking a lot about collective consciousness, and in a few minutes, I'd like to bring our friend Hatem Guda back. He will talk to us about the Earth Collective. And before that, I want to share with you a teaching by Deepak Chopra, because in order to raise collective consciousness, we have to learn how to work within our own consciousness first. So I want to give you a presentation from Deepak, because he's one of the best presenters on the subject on the planet. He's very good at integrating the information for Westerners about consciousness that's been known in the Vedanta a long time, but it's hard for Westerners raised in their matrix to get. So I really like the way he puts it here. Enjoy this.
Institute of Mind-Body Medicine in San Diego, California. Author of 12 books, including Ageless Body, Timeless Mind, Quantum Healing, and The Return of Merlin. This program is based on his bestseller, The Way of the Wizard. And now, Deepak Chopra.
Thank you very much for giving me the privilege and honor to speak to you tonight. Today's topic is going to be called The Way of the Wizard. And this is the next leap we need to take as a species to recognize that all of us are wizards, that there is deep inside us a wizard, a shaman, a healer, a genius, a Merlin that can create a life of magic for us, that can take us into the world of the miraculous and the magical, and that life can once again become enchanted. Of course, being a seer, the wizard has no gender. It is only the clumsiness of English that turns Merlin into a he, as does our language with God and prophet and seer, and many words that are far beyond male and female. Wizardess is a clumsy word, so please know that wizard applies to women as well as men. If anything, the return of the magical, has really been greeted more quickly by women in our society than anyone else. And for that, I'm grateful to womanhood. What is the wizard? How do we go about finding the wizard inside us? The route to the wizard is through the evolution of our own consciousness. Jonas Salk, the eminent scientist, the late Jonas Salk, coined the word metabiological evolution. Metabiological evolution, when he said that so-called Darwinian evolution, which was based on the survival of the fittest, is possibly over for us as a human species, that we are in a new phase of evolution, that the next stage of evolution is really the evolution of consciousness, and ultimately, it is the evolution of consciousness, of consciousness. We have been, for the last several hundred years, in a sense, victims of a response that we developed thousands of years ago, which was at that time very crucial to our survival. That response that's genetically programmed within every cell of our body And scientists recognize that response and give it a label. It's called the flight-fright response. We lived in a hostile environment as hunter-gatherers. We were surrounded by animals who found us quite delicious. And we learned to protect ourselves either by running or by fighting. And that was useful at that time. Now that same flight-fright response is triggered by imaginary fears, by traffic jams, by the stock market, by things people say to us. And that response has very limited function. What it is doing now to us is creating an epidemic of cardiovascular disease, compromised immune systems, the epidemic of cancer, degenerative disorders. But even more importantly, it has given rise to a legacy of war and hatred and predation and conquest and subjugation and ecological devastation. We have become the predators on planet Earth. And just like other predators before us, we are risking our own extinction and risking the extinction of Mother Earth and this wonderful universe of which we are a privileged species. So I think there is an urgent need for the wizard to return. There is an urgent need for the wizard to wake up within us. The wizard seeks what we have always sought deep inside us. What we have sought as humans is freedom. Ultimately, that is what we are seeking. And there are levels of freedom, of course. You ask somebody, what is freedom? Perhaps the most superficial level of freedom is, I want to be able to do what I want, when I want. A second level of freedom is the ability to fulfill our desires. And we've already covered that in another program, the Seven Spiritual Laws of Success. What is the mechanics through which we fulfill our desires? Material desires, emotional desires, spiritual desires, etc. But there is the third level of freedom. And that third level of freedom is the ability to escape the prison of the known, the prison of our past conditioning, where we are triggered by people and circumstance into predictable outcomes of behavior. We are at the mercy of every passerby in the street. And then there's a fourth level of freedom, which is the ability to make spontaneously correct choices, spontaneous right action, those choices that bring about our evolution and fulfillment, the evolution of those that are affected by that choice. And then we can go beyond that into even other levels of freedom, which we're going to explore in this program today, where we, in fact, enter realms of consciousness that are beyond waking, beyond dreaming, and beyond sleeping. 99.9% of humanity is continuously circulating between waking, dreaming, and sleeping. Are there other worlds to explore in our own consciousness? A great rishi, a great seer from the Vedic tradition of India said a long time ago, he said, infinite worlds come and go in the vast expanse of my consciousness. They're like motes of dust that are dancing in a beam of light that's shining through a hole in my roof. So that also is another level of freedom, to explore that world beyond waking, dreaming, and sleeping. And finally, freedom is to escape the boundaries of space and time, to experience ourselves in our pure essence, which is spirit. The great poet Rumi once said, "You are the unconditioned spirit that's trapped in conditions, like the sun in eclipse." The fact that the real you and me cannot be squeezed into the volume of a body or the span of a lifetime. That freedom to escape the boundaries of space and time. because we are not in space and time. You've heard the expression, you're in this world, but not of it. What does that mean? There's a part of us that is participating in space and time, and yet another part that is free as the wind and beyond, free as the dust in the dust, free as the wind in the wind. Rumi once said, in love with life, my soul lives the subtlest of passions, lives like a gypsy, each day a different house, each night under the stars. We're gypsies on planet Earth, here for a short time, here to give us and each other joy. But freedom, in that sense, can only be experienced when we begin to recognize that the real me is in this world, but not of it. And there are people in the past who have walked this way of the wizard. There have been saints and philosophers and poets and prophets and seers and sages who have walked this way in the past. And today, a lot of wizards are waking up in society. There are some very ordinary people who are not famous, who are wizards. They may be standing in the grocery store in front of you, or flying in that plane that just went by, or walking on the street before your house. It's happening at an astonishingly rapid way. Collective consciousness is merging into what can only be called, or emerging into what it can only be called, a critical mass, when everybody is going to become a wizard. And all these wizards had said the same thing. They have said that deep inside you, there is an inner intelligence. And this intelligence is the ultimate and supreme genius. It mirrors the wisdom of the universe. And when you find this intelligence, then life will become magical and miraculous for you. And this way of the wizard, this journey, which is a journey and a destination at the same time, it begins with a simple question that humanity has asked for thousands of years. The question is, who am I? Who am I? And when we first ask this question of ourselves, I think the first thing that we encounter is confusion and chaos. And that is all right. That is all right. The German philosopher Nietzsche once said, "You must have chaos within you to give birth to a dancing star." Chaos and confusion and uncertainty are the ingredients, the recipe for the emergence of clarity and intuition and order and knowledge and wisdom. Václav Havel, the founding president of the new Czechoslovakia, once said, "Keep the company and seek the company of those who are looking for the truth and run away from those who have found it." So we are on a quest together. We are on a journey together. We're not going to find the truth tonight, but we are going to find it as we go within and start exploring the realms of our own consciousness. And it's not an easy thing to do. The Upanishads of India have called it, this path of the wizard, the razor's edge, because it can be treacherous. As we first encounter our inner self, we begin to see confusion. The great Sufi poet Rumi was once asked, "Who are you?" And he said, "If you try and label me and confine me with your labels, you will starve yourself. You will starve yourself of yourself. Confine me in a box of cold words, that box will be your coffin, because I do not know who I am. I'm in astounding, lucid confusion." And he said something really beautiful. He said, "I'm your own voice echoing off the walls of God." The walls of God that are infinite, unbounded. Your own voice is another way of saying that the universe is a response of the observer. So as we go within ourselves, we find that we are a conglomeration of ambiguities, an agglutination of different archetypal energies that are stoking the fire of life in the basement of our souls. Look inside. There are sinners and saints there. There's the divine and the diabolical at the same time. There's the sacred and the profane. There's the dark night of the soul. There's the beatitude of grace. There is forbidden lust. And yet there is the ecstasy and exaltation of unconditional love. There's the simultaneous coexistence of all these opposite values. And as we begin to go through these secret passages, these dark alleys, these ghost-filled attics of our mind, then beyond all that is a world of pure spirit, of pure joy, of infinite flexibility, of unbounded possibility. It is here that we discover the secrets of the wizard that knows everything about everything when it needs to know. It is here that we find the evolution of our own consciousness through the change of the quality of our own attention. So as we walk through this way of the wizard, I'm going to take you through the different steps that we will encounter as we go past these secret passages of our own mind to find this world of pure creativity, pure knowledge, and pure wisdom. And as we look at these different aspects of our own self, we will also discover that these are the qualities of consciousness that are not really necessary sequential, that although they may unfold along the path in sometimes a seemingly sequential manner, they simultaneously coexist at the same time, like the different facets of a diamond that shine differently depending on where the light is coming from. So even though the stages of metabiological evolution, I'm using that phrase borrowed from Jonas Salk, because that's what it's all about. The phases of metabiological evolution are not just merely sequential, they're simultaneous. They're the qualities of attention of the self to itself as it discovers itself. The self to itself as it discovers itself. That's the journey we'll take today as we embark on this way of the wizard.
That's good stuff. We're going to do more of that coming up. Right now, I'd like to invite Hatem to come. Greetings, Hatem. How are you?
Good, Beth. How are you?
Doing great. So, tell us, what's new on the Earth Collective? What have you been up to?
Well, we're just, developers are designing a way. We're trying to get the website up as soon as possible. So we're working on it. A lot of complexities come up, but we work through them. So we're moving along.
That's great.
So we're hoping to make a difference. I've been reading and hearing a lot about what are the limits of collective thought power. Can it be used to stop a plague or a virus, control the weather? So we'll see. Once this is up and running, hopefully people will be attracted to it. And, we could do a lot of good things.
Yeah. It makes me think of, when I look at the headlines on the daily news and they go along with all these fake stories, right now they're trying to build up the Korea story. In the past months, they were trying to build up the Iran story, and everybody gets tired of the story, so they change the story out, And so it's a time now for mass consciousness to detach from those stories, and rewrite the script.
Yeah, it's going to be very exciting. I'm hoping that people will you know, be magnetized towards it or understand the concept. I think that's one thing that we have to sort of explain, how the collective thoughts work, and you know, where do your thoughts go when you actually think it? How do they all build up and actually work together? These are, you know, things that you know, I'm sure everyone will be curious about.
We're going to be a big experiment working together, figuring that out.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, as more people, you know, thanks to your show, a lot of people have, you know, signed up to be notified at theearthcollective.com of when the site will be up. You know, so, you know, I'm excited about it. And, you know, it's in my head all day long. I keep thinking of new things to add, but I'm holding on to it because I don't want to delay the launch of the site.
So tell me again when you think that will be.
Well, we're hoping to test at the end of this month, the end of April.
Good.
They were asking me if they can limit the functionality so that we can get it up at the end of April, and I told them no. Let's just keep on developing until, you know, there's, you know, that it's up and running. I don't want it to be half functional. I want it to be fully functional. So it may delay it a little bit. I'm not really sure.
Sure. There's no way of knowing until the programmers get further along.
Yeah, they email me every day. Sometimes, you know, one of the guys who's involved in the scripts is sick or he has a cold. So, you know, so that delays it. Stuff we can't control.
Right, right. Well, it's very exciting. I can't wait.
Thanks. Me too. I can't wait as well. I'm visualizing millions of people on this site every day. You know, cleaning the water, you know, sending healing thoughts to the earth, you know, it's going to be pretty creative. So, we'll wait and see.
I heard about this movement in the UK called the Transition Movement. And what it is people getting involved at their local levels with projects, and the purpose is to, recreate, you know, the new earth into what we want it to be, with sustainable food and education and different initiatives that they're doing. And anybody can set up a transitions in their own town. And so it would be kind of fun to take these new initiatives to your website and then put energy to them and see what happens with that and link the two.
Definitely. The developers that I stumbled upon are actually involved in Unity meditation that was happening in last year. So I stumbled upon them because they had built the site for Unity Meditation 2012 for, you know, the Mayan calendar. So they actually had a lot of ideas. They're very excited about the idea. We're going to list local activities. Like one of the developers was mentioning that they like to, you know, get a bunch of people together and go clean up the beach. So they want to post those kind of activities on the site as well. I said, great, let's do it. So not only will there be thoughts to heal and so on, there will also list activities for, you know, people to come together.
There's really no limit what you can do with your website. It's so exciting.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm very anxious to get it up and going just to see what it can do.
Sounds good.
Thanks.
So will you be back here and join us again tomorrow?
Yes. I was a little bit of a hiatus. I don't know. All this energy coming in. I didn't know what to do with myself. I felt like I just wanted to get on a rocket and just take off. And I guess I did take off and I re-landed.
That's great. We're glad to have you back.
Thanks.
Those energies made me feel like taking a nap.
They make me want to explode, so I sort of, you know, just go off in my own little world.
That sounds good. Well, I think we're going to wrap it up with a meditation now. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
We'll pick this up tomorrow again.
Okay.
Thanks, Atem. Okay, everybody. let's do a little guided imagery today to help us relax. Okay, I'm just pulling it up here. I'm going to read it to you. Hold on, I want to get set up the right way. This is the this is called Bliss of Nature, and apparently it's bliss encoded music recording. I had introduced this to you before. I started using this as the background music for when I do my workouts, and I noticed that those complaints that run through your mind, you know, how much longer and all that stuff when you're doing your sit-ups and stuff, it doesn't happen anymore when I play this when I do my workout. It might be a sugar pill. I don't really care, but my stomach's getting flatter, so somehow on some level that's working for me. All right, everybody, please let's do a meditation together. This is called Moonlight Over the Lake. Choose your preferred relaxation. It is a warm summer evening. You are walking along the shore of a small mountain lake. The lake is deserted, except for a lone fisherman casting from the shore. The sun is sinking fast behind the silhouette of trees on the far shore. Throwing its last rays across the water, allowing a swarm of insects a last dance in the golden light. Then even that fades away. There is a moment of perfect stillness in the silent twilight between day and night, except for a light splash of a fish or a frog and the last sweet notes of a bird's evening song. A full moon has risen, its light reflecting on the still lake. The night is filled with the sweet fragrance of pine, and you feel the worries and concerns of the day slipping away. All is still, and you are flooded with a warm feeling of contentment and peace. You perceive a sense of harmony between yourself and your surroundings. You are keenly aware of the inherent connection that exists between yourself and your environment. It reawakens your sense of responsibility to do your part, just your part, to cherish and preserve the beauty of moments like these, on the overall importance of being gentle and caring with our Mother Earth. Reflect on this thought for a moment. Slowly, let the image of the mountain lake fade away. Become aware again of your surroundings and notice the feel of your body. Take a few slow and deep breaths and stretch your entire body. When you are ready, open your eyes. Take with you the thoughts and lessons you have learned during this moment of quiet reflection. Thank you, everybody, for sharing this meditation with me. I like to give everybody a chance to just wind down, even for a few moments, and see how that changes your life. Have a wonderful day, and please come back tomorrow. Namaste.